How old are the kids?
Mine are 11, 13, and 16. Three boys.
Oh, my God. You were up to the same sort of naughty business about the same on the same day as I was, by the sounds of things, because mine are 11, 14, and 16.
I love it. Yeah, I find
what are you
it,
doing on the 3rd of January, 2010?
I'm Rufus Griscom, and this is The Next Big Idea. Today, what if our technological progress is not linear? What if it's exponential? What will the world look like in 10 years, and do we have a say? My next-door neighbors are building a new house, and this has been the soundtrack of my life for the last few months. Sawing. Drilling. Hammering. So much hammering. According to the U.S. Census Bureau, it takes 7 months to build a house, and it seems to be taking twice as long in our corner of Long Island. But in Austin, Texas, they figured out how to build a house in less than a week. It's all thanks to a 5-ton machine and a 30-something lay minister turned entrepreneur.
We are just doing something that is barely this side of science fiction.
That's Jason Ballard, the co-founder and CEO of Icon, the first company in America to secure a building permit for a 3D-printed home. The 5-ton machine, it's called the Vulcan. It's 46 feet wide and 15 feet tall. It looks, as one observer put it, like a gigantic soft serve machine oozing out neat lines of concrete. It's controlled by an iPad, meticulously adheres to a digital blueprint, needs only 3 people to operate, and it's capable of pouring the foundation and building the walls of a 2-story, 3,000 square foot house in just a few days.
Robotic construction is absolutely our future. This is a complete transformation in the way that we approach sheltering ourselves, in the way that we approach building.
If only my neighbors had known. They could have spared me this months-long headache. So far, Icon has raised more than $250 million, sold a few homes in Texas, and constructed a 3D-printed housing development in Mexico for families living in extreme poverty. Now the company has partnered with one of the nation's leading home builders to create the largest neighborhood of 3D-printed homes in the country. When a reporter for Axios announced the 100-home community, he wrote, 3D-printed cement houses are about to take off, offering a cheaper, more efficient way to provide homes for those who need them. And a lot of people need them. The U.S. faces a housing deficit of 5 million homes. So it's a heartwarming story. Guy wants to be a priest, but realizes he can do more good by becoming an entrepreneur. Establishes a radical new technology to squeeze out durable, low-cost homes. Solves America's housing crisis, and we all live happily ever after, the end. But my reading is a little more cautious. To me, it's a reminder of how quickly our world is changing. 100 years ago, fewer than 1% of U.S. homes had electricity and indoor plumbing. And now, Icon has plans to 3D print a colony on the moon. On the positive side, it's not so scary to imagine that the headache-inducing sound of construction in my neighborhood and in yours will soon be replaced by giant 3D printers quietly extruding new homes. But what happens to those clamorous construction workers? Are they permanently out of work now? And what about the cultural shift? Ask any child, or any adult for that matter, to draw you a house, and they'll probably draw a rectangular building with a triangular roof, not some curvy 3D printed thing with walls that look like rows of buttercream frosting spiraling up the side of a cake. Are we ready for a world that looks and feels radically different? There's no stopping the acceleration of technological progress, which is exciting and unsettling, but we can change how we respond to it. And the question of how we do that is at the heart of a new book called The Exponential Age: How Accelerating Technology is Transforming Business, Politics, and Society. It was written by our guest today, Azeem Azar. New technologies, Azeem says, are emerging and growing at an unprecedented pace. If you plotted it out on a graph, the curve of their development would be exponential. But our economic systems, cultural norms, and political institutions evolve linearly. They just can't keep up. We already see the consequences of this every day. the systems we've established to protect our privacy don't work so well in the internet age. Our existing labor laws prove to be pretty clumsy when we apply them to new kinds of gig work. If we don't move quickly to close the gap between runaway technologies and slow-moving institutions, we could be in pretty big trouble. I've known Azeem for 20 years. I'm an avid reader of his newsletter, Exponential View, and a fan of his podcast of the same name. He's a big thinker, someone who's comfortable talking about policy, technology, economics, science, history, just the kind of author we love here at The Next Big Idea. I reached him at his home in London, where he was able to carve out a little time to chat before running off to get a much-needed haircut.
The LinkedIn Podcast Network is sponsored by HubSpot. Imagine growing a business with high-quality leads, fast closing deals, and wildly happy customers. It's not a miracle. It's HubSpot. Visit HubSpot.com to get started today.
Azeem Azar, welcome to the Next Big Idea podcast.
Rufus, it is such a pleasure to be talking to you again.
Indeed. Remind me of when we first crossed paths.
We would have met in the mid to late 90s when you had set up Nerve magazine or webzine, which was, I think, it's sort of a dating and sort of sex tips, amongst other things, journal, I suppose, a precursor to something a bit like Vice, maybe in some ways. And I was working as the internet correspondent at The Economist. And so I was often trying to figure out what was going on. And you know, we met then, and then secretly, as a, you know, lonely man in my mid-20s, I was reading Nerve to learn about how to get on with the dating game.
Well, my mother, who listens to this podcast, will be not delighted to be reminded of my sordid past with Nerve.com. But yes, no, those were wonderful days. And Stephen Johnson was running Feed magazine. And it was, you know, what was interesting was that we had the sense within the early internet days that this was a new kind of printing press that made possible new kinds of pamphleteers. You know, I mean, our first instinct was to take advantage of the medium for arts and culture, and that's changed quite a bit.
I think people now forget actually just how fun the internet was in 1994, 95, 96, becoming a publisher yourself or discovering some quirky new experiment. And you look back on them and they seem so naive, but it was incredibly refreshing back at the time.
Azeem, you begin your new book, The Exponential Age, by mentioning a lecture that the British scientist and novelist C.P. Snow gave back in 1959. In that lecture, Snow warned that intellectual life was being split between two factions, I think, right? On the one side, you had the scientists, and on the other, you had artsy Oxford graduates who looked down their noses at technology. And Snow's view was that between these two cultures, there was a gulf of mutual incomprehension. And you say that gulf has only gotten wider. Today, we have technologists on one side, the engineers, the people who work in Silicon Valley. And on the other side, there's everyone else. And it strikes me, Azeem, that you are just the man to help bridge the gulf of mutual incomprehension, because you were one of those artsy Oxford grads. You edited one of the university's newspapers and its student magazine, but you're also a tech guy. You founded 4 tech companies and invested in more than 30 startups. You're a member of the World Economic Forum's Global Futures Council. Since 2015, you've been running the highly influential newsletter Exponential View, and you host a podcast of the same name for the Harvard Business Review. I say all that first and foremost, Azeem, to flatter you. We like to soften up our guests. But also because I really do want to know, do you see yourself as a negotiator between these two cultures?
My life is entirely about negotiation, Rufus. Thank you for that introduction. I joke that I'm a Libran. And for those of you who are into your astrology, the Libra is the scales, the one that tries to find a balance. And I was also the youngest child in a family of 5 with too much elder sisters, and so would always find myself in a kind of attempting to be in a peacemaking role, and I had a peacemaking role in school as well. So I've always found myself as someone who was a bridge, and I think because my interests spanned from science to history and technology to politics, in my career, I found myself as the one person who could talk to the people in the marketing department and the people in the technology department and understand them and perhaps take their message over to the other side. And that's, I think, why I felt more comfortable writing a book that is a book that attempts to bridge these two different domains than focusing 100% on any one aspect.
So interesting about your background. I didn't know that about the birth order and the instinct to bridge divides. Because I also see that in your work in the divide between kind of corporate cultures and startup cultures, and then I also see it between the techno optimists and the pessimists. Because among other things that divide these two groups, there may be an ocean known as the Atlantic. I was interested to discover that the subtitle of the UK version of your book is How Accelerating Technology is Leaving Us Behind and What to Do About It. Meanwhile, the subtitle of the American version, the US version, is How Accelerating Technology is Transforming Business, Politics, and Society. It seems like two ways of looking at the same phenomenon.
It is exactly two ways of looking at the same phenomenon. And it isn't just a transatlantic divide. When I look at the reviews of the book in the mainstream press, some have painted me as a pessimist and some have painted me as an optimist. And I think that in a way, that's a sign that I may have achieved what I set out to do, which was not to offend everybody, but rather to help identify just how complex and nuanced this discussion needs to be. And that has been, I think, perhaps one of the things that I've been happiest with has been that there have been different interpretations taken of the book, because I was hoping to move past a narratives of technology that are either prototypically utopian or dystopian. I wanted to present something that was somewhere in the balance, something a little bit Libra, that was a bit pragmatic and complicated and needed to be navigated and negotiated.
Well, I too am a Libra, although I didn't know my sign until I was in my late 20s. I was very proud of the fact until somebody told me what it was. But it does apply, because I have the same instinct. Although I've always thought that we live in a world that's changing. And as you point out, and this is sort of central to the thesis of the book, the pace of that change is accelerating. It's always struck me that being a friend of change is a good life strategy when you're living in a world in which change is inevitable. Right? If you register change as traumatic, you're kind of in a pickle. And, obviously we need to learn to accentuate the upsides of change and mitigate the downsides, which is what you're doing while investing in tech startups and also in parallel helping governments and companies, mitigate the downsides. I found the book extremely exciting and hopeful.
Oh, well, thank you. Yeah, I think it is a hopeful book, because what I wanted people to do is understand that there is a fundamental shift that is going on. And I'm not saying this with excitement left or right. I'm saying that if you look at what happens in complex economies with increasing levels of education and more interconnections, you will see these patterns of acceleration in certain areas. So in a sense, I'm saying, look, it's going to go and rain, and you can decide whether you want to dance in the rain or get an umbrella. And giving you that choice of dancing and getting the umbrella is the positive message. It is a sense that you can have some agency around this. But I should say that in that presentation, I'm not saying that technology is deterministic. I'm not saying that, there are inevitabilities about the way technologies act, and every word processor that could have been produced would have been like Microsoft Word, or every social network would have been like Instagram. Because I think that those are design choices. Those are choices that we as the people who create the technology can take, and we can shape it in those directions. But I am saying that there are some fundamental things that are going on in the way our economies operate that point towards this acceleration. And if we are going to then make sense of it, a really, really reasonable strategy would be to say, how am I going to deal with the change that is coming?
And if we think of an exponential curve of a hockey stick, we might be right at the point where it's about to go vertical, which is exciting and perhaps alarming, which I think is a great segue to big idea number one.
We're at a transition point. Now, I've been involved in technology for 25 years, although my background in education was in the social sciences. And starting about 2015, after I sold my last company, I spent time exploring a number of different technologies and looking at how they were turning into products and services and ultimately into companies. And I came to a conclusion during this research, during this discovery, that we really were at a transition point across advanced economies, across our societies, one that was being driven by a number of broadly applicable general technologies. Those were the technologies of computing, which many of us are familiar with the ever-marching power of our smartphones, but also in the realms of biology, where we're able to take the approaches and disciplines of engineering and apply them to the human genome, to the way in which we create proteins, to starting to get microorganisms to make new materials for us. I also saw trends in energy, where the cost to produce energy from renewable sources like solar and wind was declining precipitously. And in tandem, the cost of energy storage in the form of batteries was also getting cheaper and cheaper, promising that we would have affordable tools of clean, renewable energy today or very soon. And a final area of technology, that of manufacturing, where new techniques, 3D printing or additive manufacturing, which are hitherto contained in small niches in our industries like aerospace and automotive, were improving dramatically year on year, getting cheaper and better, and so are on the cusp of becoming everyday parts of our industry. Now, the interesting point about these four technology areas is they're broadly applicable across our economies, but more than that, they are improving exponentially. And by that, I mean they are improving by more than 10% on a price performance basis every single year, year after year, compounding those improvements, and often for many decades historically and for many, many, many years to come. The impact of that is a tremendous reduction in the cost of these fantastic capabilities. And with those, that reduction in cost, we're going to start to see a ubiquity of these approaches across our economies and societies more broadly.
All right. Well, why don't we start, Azim, by blowing people's minds a little bit about what exponential technological progress is likely to mean for us in the next 20 years. I mean, I think a lot of us have this sort of vague sense that, you know, tech is exciting and maybe a little bit scary. Things are changing. I'm not sure that the average person on the street necessarily believes that the changes coming in the next 20 years are likely to be even more powerful and perhaps also more disruptive than the last 20 years. Why don't we start with computing? We've all been on this ride together. 1960s, you know, Gordon Moore, as co-founder of Intel, came up with his famous law. Moore's law states that the number of transistors you can pack onto a circuit will double every 2 years. At that time, the densest microchips held around 2,000 transistors. Apple's M1 Max chip, just introduced last month, has 57 billion transistors. Is this pace going to continue? And what do you think are the implications?
Well, I mean, it is mind-blowing. And the numbers still befuddle me. People, for a long time, the last 10 or 15 years, people have said that the rate of improvement of silicon chips or the availability of computation, I think it's helpful to think of it as the availability of computation, would have to slow down because the way that the process that Moore's law described was one of miniaturization. You would take these transistors. Yeah. They used to be in the late 1950s about the size of a fingernail, and you shrink them down, and they're now the size of, you know, nanometers. So not quite a bit bigger than sort of atom scale, we would say. And so for 20 years, people have been saying, look, Moore's law, this relationship, descriptive relationship, will come to an end, and computation will start to not get cheaper and cheaper. What we actually found is that the reverse has been the case. So even though it's got harder to make more and more miniaturized chips, other techniques have shown up, whether it's what's known as new architectures, so new ways of designing the chips, whether it's new applications. And they have delivered incredible improvements in computational capacity. The one that's been most interesting has been what we call artificial intelligence. We've got this new artificial intelligence wave that started in about 2011. And these algorithms need so much more computational power than anything we've had before. And between 2013 and 2018, the state-of-the-art AI algorithms demanded 300,000 times more computation. That's much faster than Moore's Law can provide. And yet the computer industry was able to figure out chips that were faster and faster and faster that were just optimized for those AI tasks. And so we've actually, in a way, gone faster than Moore's Law as far as a machine learning developer would care, as far as a company would care. And as we look out 20 years, I don't think there are many reasons to believe that we would slow down. In fact, what we've seen is the rate of progress in what we can do with chips has sped up somewhat. You talked about the new Apple chip, but more importantly, the AI developers are becoming more and more demanding. And it's that ballet between the demanding user, the AI developer, and the willingness of the industry to innovate and figure out how to meet those demands that creates a really important flywheel that should drive us forward even faster. And I think all those building blocks are in place. And then, of course, we have the Hail Mary card, which is the new technologies of quantum computing.
Quantum computers literally use individual atoms resting in undetermined quantum states called superpositions to perform calculations.
And quantum computing, you know, has its own limits in terms of what it can be applied to. But the early results of quantum computing, again, have me scrabbling for my thesaurus to find, you know, whatever number comes beyond quadrillion. And I'm not sure what it is, but quantum computers are, from what we've seen so far in their small scale, quadrillions of times faster than traditional quantum computers. I mean, I talk of a test that Google did with a very, very primordial quantum computer back in 2019. And it did a particular task in 200 seconds, and it would have taken a normal supercomputer 100,000 years. So that is the scale of the shift.
Let's talk about energy. I found this very hopeful. In the last decade, you say the price of electricity generated by solar has declined by 89% just in the last 10 years. The price of wind energy has dropped by 70%. You say no other form of electricity production can compete now with these renewable energy sources. Coal plants no longer make sense. That may also be true soon of natural gas. Do you think this pace of progress will continue? And what are the implications of this?
I would expect it to continue, especially with solar photovoltaic, those shiny cells that turn sunlight into electricity, because they have many of the similar properties to early silicon chips. They're all about miniaturizing circuits on a silicon substrate. But it's already having a significant impact in the market. I mean, one of the key things is that because in nearly every part of the world, it is, I mean, according to Bloomberg New Energy Finance, who studies these things, it's every part of the world, you're better off from a cost perspective creating a solar or a wind based electrical system than starting up a new coal plant or a new natural gas plant. And that means that the decision on the investment side is much, much more straightforward. And one of the things that we've seen that should give us a lot of hope is that what's known as the cost of capital, the price that a developer needs to pay on the capital they borrow to build a power station, has really bifurcated. And in fact, it's 15% per annum cheaper on your interest payments to build a solar or a gas plant than it is to build a coal plant. And so not only is the coal person having to sell more expensive electricity, they're paying much higher finance costs in order to do that, which really then crushes their margin, right? And crushes their opportunity in the market. And that, I think, should make us feel a bit optimistic.
And then you also say that that we may be moving towards a world with effectively free energy, right? I mean, that there might be such an abundance of energy at such low costs that it fundamentally changes the playing field. How does that affect the way the world functions in, you know, out a few decades?
You know, the secret is that it's all about energy, and it's all about the laws of thermodynamics and the idea that in a closed system, entropy always increases, and we have to spend energy to reverse those processes. And so whenever we look at an industrial process, we often throw energy into it to get it to work. And that means that when we want to create nitrogen-based fertilizers today, we have to use lots of temperature and lots of pressure at a great energy cost to squeeze nitrogen in the atmosphere out and smush it with hydrogen to produce ammonia. And all of that is expensive, and it's expensive from the perspective of the carbon dioxide we put in the atmosphere. When we move to a world with essentially free energy, it becomes close to free to get over those laws of thermodynamics. And we can start to do things that we don't do because they're thermodynamically expensive. And I'll give you two or three examples. So one example would be how we produce hydrogen. I mean, hydrogen is an amazing fuel. It's incredibly clean, but there isn't much of it naturally available. So we either have to produce it by reforming methane, which puts out quite a lot of CO2 in the atmosphere. That's not good. Or we do it through electrolyzing water, which is, you know, H2O, and that gives us hydrogen and oxygen. Very benign, very useful. Mm. The trouble is that electricity, clean electricity, has traditionally been too expensive. So clean hydrogen has been too expensive to use as an energy storage medium. But if the price of electricity continues to fall, as I expect it will mean that clean hydrogen could become abundantly available as a storage medium. I mean, and that's just one example. But if we even think about things like cleaning up waste and pollution and so on, that is something that is that currently we go off and we bury it, because to reverse the chemical processes and get useful materials out of waste uses a lot of energy, which is expensive. Once energy is free, well, it becomes a little bit like, I don't know if you remember Mr. Fusion, the thing that was on the top of the DeLorean in the second episode of Back to the Future. Yeah.
Marty, you've got to come back with me.
Where?
Back to the Future.
Wait a minute, what are you doing, Doc?
I need fuel.
I mean, it's not Mr. Fusion, but it's a bit like that. Yeah. We can take our old banana skins and egg cartons and turn them into useful things. And because the energy is free and it's also renewable, we're doing it with a zero carbon footprint as well.
Why don't we talk about synthetic biology? That was extraordinary to me. That you talk about turning microorganisms into little factories to make biopolymers, I think like plastics that are biodegradable, I guess, and even electrical components. People say that as much as 60% of the physical inputs of the global economy could be produced biologically by 2040. That's pretty stunning.
It's amazing. I love this area. I didn't understand it for years. I was fortunate to be able to speak to people who really knew what they were talking about. And eventually it started to make sense to me. We know that there are incredible things that exist in nature, whether it's salicylic acid, which is a natural chemical that turns out to become aspirin, which is it called aspirin in the US, by the way?
Yes, it is. Yeah.
It is. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So, which becomes aspirin, great for headaches. Or you think about spider silk, which is not just beautiful, but incredibly strong and incredibly light. These are remarkable properties of materials and chemicals that have evolved through this process of evolution over you know, hundreds of millions and billions of years. And they're done with such great elegance. And you compare that little house spider as she spins a web, producing a silk that is better than any polystyrene or polyester material that we might produce industrially. And you go to where we produce those things, and essentially we are exploding hydrocarbons in containment units in big industrial plants, and it's ugly and it's toxic and it's polluting and it uses so much energy. So there is this elegance in nature, and the promise of synthetic biology is that we can learn to harness that elegance, and we do it through a set of exponential technologies, from the ability to read the genomes of different living things, figure out which genes could be responsible for expressing a particular protein, which means sort of expressing the thing that turns into the spider silk or the transparent film or the therapeutic. Then we need to be able to use another exponential technology to synthesize those genes, and we get these artificial genes that we then need to, you know, insert into the appropriate microorganism that can then go off and brew and produce the product that we want. So it's really, really complicated. So you have to bring all of these exponential technologies, from the ability to read genes and write them and insert them and engineer cells, the ability to use machine learning to figure out what combinations could work. Because this is biology and it's not deterministic, it is a systems problem that, and a bit probabilistic. You don't necessarily know what is going to express well in the yields that you need. So you have to run lots of experiments. And these synthetic biology companies now have robotic wet labs. So rather than getting grad students to run one experiment every couple of days, they run hundreds in parallel. And that's after having run millions of virtual experiments in simulation. Wow. And at the end of it, hopefully, you come out with an answer that allows you to, with the elegance of nature, produce that therapy that you want or produce that material that you want. And, you know, I've looked at the forecasts for this. I have some sort of friends in the McKinsey team that come up with the forecasts, and they reckon it's a $4 trillion business by, 2030 or 2040. And, you know, I really hope that they are wrong. I mean, I think it could be so much bigger than that.
And this reminds me of 3D printing, right? Which is another, right, you know, huge, huge category of innovation. You say that the 3D printing market grew 11-fold in the last decade, a pace of 27% year over year. In the next decade, we're likely to see performance improve 14-fold with prices dropping. You have a friend who printed the world's largest 3D printed object in 2019, a 2,500 square foot concrete building. It took 17 days to build using 75% less concrete and was built with unheard of precision. So what do we have to look forward to here?
Well, I'm so out of date in the exponential age that the gap between sending a book to press and things being, extended even further is, you know, just everything gets transformed. You know, 3D printing is improving at about 30% per annum on a price performance basis. And we are seeing people 3D print components of houses or large parts of houses. And in fact, there was recently a story in the Wall Street Journal about 3D printed, rapidly constructed homes in Austin, in Texas. I think the key thing here with 3D printing is that it's a very generalized technology, and you control it with the same types of software. You can use lots of different types of feedstock. So you're seeing people 3D print with artificial meats and artificial fish proteins so that you have this sort of cruelty-free, sustainable meat that is available. You're seeing people, this is more for the chill out crew, 3D printing with cannabis in other ways. We're getting people 3D printing with discarded wood to create high-end interiors for cars. So you take the kind of waste wood and you smush it chemically and you turn it into a feedstock, and out comes what looks like a beautiful walnut that you pop into a high-end car. And I think that that's quite a remarkable shift. The challenge with 3D printing has been that, compared to mass manufacturing processes like casting or molding, it's just really expensive if you need a million of something, right? If you need a million of something, make a mold and just kind of pour the metal in there and so on. But, you know, true exponential form at quite large numbers now, sometimes hundreds, sometimes thousands of copies, 3D printing is cost competitive with those traditional molding or casting processes. And that's really nice because it's a much more sustainable process, but it still allows that personalization, which, you know, gives a little bit more delight, right? Because the sneakers fit you just perfectly because your left foot's a bit smaller than your right foot or vice versa. But it's really, really early days, I should say, Rufus. I mean, we should be under no illusions that 3D printing has not had its iPhone moment yet. Mm-hmm. But we could also feel cautiously optimistic that it might.
Which is really difficult for most of us squishy Homo sapiens to fully comprehend. And that lack of comprehension is at the heart of Azeem's second big idea. He'll share it right after the break.
The LinkedIn Podcast Network is sponsored by Alumni Ventures. Access unparalleled venture investment opportunities with Alumni Ventures, America's largest venture firm for individual investors. Tap into industries like AI, health tech, and deep tech to invest in companies that were previously inaccessible. Visit av.vc to learn more about how Alumni Ventures can be your venture investing partner.
Welcome back to the show. Azeem Azar's first big idea is that technology is accelerating exponentially. And the problem, he says, in his next big idea, is that our institutions can't keep up.
There is an exponential gap between the potentials of these technologies and the linearity of our everyday lives. So on the one hand, the technologies are exploding. They're creating these future potentials. They're creating new, fast-moving, aggressively expanding companies that are changing the nature of commerce and work and the organization of cities. But on the other hand, in most well-functioning societies, we rely on formal and informal institutions, whether it is regulations around cars or employment laws or the way we think about tax or the laws that govern how corporations should behave. Or perhaps it's just informal customs and habits that just make life easier for us to live. The challenge is that those institutions, whether formal or informal, tend to evolve at a very, very linear rate. And because they change at a linear rate, they get out of step with the realities of the exponential technologies. And I call that gap between this accelerating upward curve and this linear flat curve the exponential gap. And the exponential gap is the thing that underpins so many of the tensions that we see between these fast-moving technologies and the companies that build them and the way in which we have sort of run our societies up to now, whether it's in markets and industries and questions of market dominance, or whether it's in the field of work and how well workers can be treated, whether it's in trade or security and conflict, or perhaps most presently in what happens to our democratic fabric and our ability to act as citizens. These tensions can be traced back to the exponential gap. It's a useful analytical tool for us to understand, diagnose, and ultimately fix these issues.
When we think about we as humans just process all this technological change and adapt to it and respond to it, I think about this amazing graph in your book that shows how long it took different technologies in the U.S. to go from 10% penetration to 75%, right? For electricity and the automobile and the telephone, it took over 50 years to get from that kind of 10% penetration to 75%. For the cell phone and internet, it took a little over 20 years. For social media, it took 11 years to reach 7 out of 10 Americans. For the smartphone, I think it was about 8 years. So smartphones reached 75% market penetration, 12 and a half times faster than the original telephone. And this has implications, both economic and political implications, but also implications in terms of how it impacts our own personal psychology, our daily habits, our culture, our behavior. It's a disorienting time, isn't it?
I think it's really disorienting. And it is something that the technology industry itself hasn't been empathetic enough in the language that it's used.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
Around the changes that are happening. We are not well constituted for dealing with change that is as quick as this. And by which I mean that we just are not able to make good predictions about where these curves will go. Most banally, many of us start saving for our pensions or our 401ks far too late in life. I mean, given the power of compound interest, we should start with the very first paycheck we get, not the day before our 50th birthday. So we don't grok what exponential change does in the first order. And what's challenging, as you've so lucidly pointed out, is that the second and third order applications of that change can be so much further away. I mean, who knew that by giving people unlimited computing power in a portable device, the smartphone, we would end up using it to look at pictures of cats and get into arguments with strangers. I mean, that's not what you would think in the 1950s unlimited computing power would give you.
Yeah.
And that's what it's ended up giving us. And so this is sort of psychologically very difficult for us to deal with. But it's difficult for a second reason, which is that much of the world that we live in is livable because of conventions and habits and laws and institutions. Mm-hmm. The fact that you know which side of the road to drive on when you are in the US, and I know which side of the road to drive on when I'm in the UK. That is a simple convention that makes life livable and survivable. And our institutions are predicated on the circumstances that were around when they were created. And so they don't necessarily adjust as quickly as we need to in this exponential age. And so we have this challenge. You know, we as individuals are not well constituted to contend with the first order change, let alone the downstream implications. And for me, the exponential gap is the point that sits between the optimism of the power and the abundance of these technologies and the dystopianism of things going wrong. Because in short, Rufus, I think what happens is that because of this gap, there ends up becoming a shift in power from the rest of us towards the handful of people who can best maximize the new potentials. But it's not a simple shift in power. It's not like, you know, my Ford franchise beat your Ford franchise in Poughkeepsie, New York, and I'm now the one who's bought the bigger house. It's much, much more fundamental than that. It is about a battle for how our societies get structured, what our economies look like, what our industries look like, what does work look like? Does our democratic politics work at all? And so from this little thing, this misunderstanding of what the implications of this exponential change will be, arise these much, much more systemic challenges. And for me, figuring out how we close that gap is an absolutely sort of key part of the puzzle.
Let's talk about those what you call superstar companies, which it's just extraordinary what's happened, right, with Apple, Amazon, Google, Microsoft, Facebook. To watch companies worth trillions of dollars growing at 20% year over year, 30% year over year, it's just unfathomable. For decades now, the conventional wisdom was Apple can't possibly keep growing at this rate, right? They're about to hit the headwinds of scale. And it just hasn't happened. And that assumption that these companies were going to hit headwinds was not irrational. As you point out, in the 20th century, large companies very consistently slowed down. They maxed out at maybe 40% market penetration. Somehow these new companies have broken the constraints of gravity that have limited the growth of large-scale companies for centuries. Why is that?
I find this amazing. I mean, it is a remarkable shift because I grew up learning the economic orthodoxy that said companies can only get so big. And the reasons are that in the olden days, in the 1990s, companies were dependent on inputs, and inputs would get progressively more expensive. That millionth kilogram or pound of steel that you bought cost much more than the first pound of steel that you bought. And that's just what happened in the market. And the second thing that happened was that your business would get more complicated. It became bureaucratic and sclerotic. And so as the organization got larger, coupled with rising input costs, you created space for a competitor to come in and slice off a bit of the market. What happens in the exponential age is that companies look like something that we call platforms, which I'm sure many listeners sort of have heard that word. But the heart of the being the platform is that you benefit from something called a network effect. And the network effect is simply this, that every additional customer benefits all the previous customers. And that's why a dating service like Tinder is different to an airline. No one goes onto an airplane and is delighted to hear that it's oversold and you're going to be sort of elbow to elbow the whole way through. You're actually delighted when you're told, oh, you're so lucky, Mr. Griscom. No one else booked this flight and you've got the whole thing to yourself. That's not how a dating app works, right? A dating app is a disaster if it's just you on your own, right? It's better that it's oversold and overcrowded. And that is the network effect that is at the heart of platform companies. And it turns out that exponential age companies in many, many guises end up using network effects on top of their platforms, which means that as they get bigger, they become better reasons for more customers to use them, and they'll get bigger still. And when I think about back to the early start of the research for this book, which was in 2016, I remember a dinner that I had in a very upscale London hotel with a set of wealthy investors. And there was no company that was worth more than $500 or $600 billion. And I said, you know, are these companies overvalued? And pretty much every person said, yes, they're overvalued. And there was one person who sort of said, they're overvalued, but I can imagine them getting up to $600 or $700 billion in market capitalization. Here we are 5 years later, where many of them are worth more than $1 trillion, and Apple and Microsoft are worth more than $2.5 trillion. And somehow they have broken the rules of 20th century business. And they've done that because the rules of 21st century business, the rules of business in the exponential age, are actually just different.
Let's take a quick break. When we come back, Azeem tells us about the implications of that rule breaking and what we can do about it. Welcome back to the show. So Azeem's first big idea is that we're at a transition point. Emerging technologies are about to fundamentally change the way we live and work, how we power our homes and offices, how we solve problems and build new things. His second big idea is that there's a worrisome gap between those technologies and the institutions that should, in theory, regulate them. Now, in his third and final big idea, he says, we can close that gap.
We can close this gap. Now, I think it's quite hard for us to look at the pace of technical development and come in and somehow slow it down. I mean, I argue in the book that the reason these technologies develop as fast as they do, it is really a function of having a modern complex economy where the engineers and the entrepreneurs and the scientists learn from their experience and respond to the signals in the market. So at one level, the pace is almost set. But there are things we can do because technologies are artifacts. They are designed and created by people, and we are those people. So if we are able to understand how they develop, understand how they progress, start to think a little bit about their second and third order impacts outside of the narrow sphere of technology into society at large, we can actually start to shape their direction. We can start to allocate resources appropriately, direct the power of this river of innovation into ways that we might find being more helpful. But it's also important that for people who are not necessarily in the technology industry, to have the tools to ask the right questions so that they can participate either as customers or consumers or citizens in this emerging question, this emerging challenge of how do we govern the potentials of all these technologies.
Forrester predicted a few years ago that 25 million U.S. workers could lose their jobs to automation by 2027. Meanwhile, you cite some Oxford academics who say that as much as 47% of the U.S. workforce is at risk of redundancy. It's a painful word due to machine learning. Meanwhile, on the other hand, you say historically our economies have become more automated and historically employment levels have tended to increase. I get the sense you're not as concerned, Azim, about an actual decline of jobs that are available as you are concerned about the growing gap in the quality of jobs that are available. Is that right?
I am definitely worried about the quality of jobs that the majority of the workforce can expect to access. And I am also concerned about what happens in the short to medium term when we go through a transition. And the reason I'm concerned with those aspects is that history has shown us that time and again, dramatic new technologies like early mechanization has, for reasons of power, more than anything else, tended to favor the providers of capital. And in the 19th century, the British economy, the English economy grew very, very rapidly. But workers' wages didn't keep up. And it grew rapidly because of mechanization. And it wasn't until the turn of the 19th to the 20th century that the force of the organized labor movement created enough political will to adjust that. And that 50 or 60 year period was known as the Engels pause. After Friedrich Engels' analysis of what was going on, it was a time that really, apart from the providers of capital, you know, Charles Dickens did very well because he wrote many, many novels about this gap, about poor workers living in terrible conditions while the country got richer and richer. So those are the things I think that we need to worry about right now, in the same way that we can't really imagine what happens at the end of exponential changes. We also can't really imagine what sectors of the economy will grow and the extent to which they will grow. I mean, try to explain to someone living in the Plymouth colony in the mid-17th century what an auditor does or what a yoga teacher does. It doesn't make any sense, and yet it makes great sense to us today. So I feel that we will create new types of work, new types of jobs that will be hard or impossible to automate. But before we get there, we'll be people living real lives with a sense of fear, of losing their livelihoods, of losing their sense of worth, of losing their purpose. And those are the things that I worry about.
There's a possibility, I think, that I've become very interested in the implications of blockchain and what might be coming down the pike in terms of solutions to both distribution of wealth and how technology is impacting distribution of wealth. I was fascinated by your conversation, Azim, with James Courier, the venture capitalist at NFX, about decentralized autonomous organizations and how they could potentially create more competitive kinds of network platforms that might rectify some of the concentration of wealth problems that private networks have created.
This is potentially powerful because more and more businesses that used to be traditional B2C companies are becoming networks, from retail to delivery to publishing platforms. Let's define some terms here. Blockchains are networks of computers capable of making commitments based on shared code. They can make commitments to scarcity, such as there will only ever be 21 million Bitcoins, or contractual commitments, such as this piece of digital art or NFT is owned by Azim Azar. And decentralized autonomous organizations, or DAOs for short, are new kinds of organizations that are governed using blockchain.
I think that we are at the cusp where we get to, in some sense, decide the shape of the future, and that something like blockchains and decentralized autonomous organizations could form part of that, because they do, in a sense, extend the framing of democracy to new realms, right? To how we allocate resources, amongst other things. But we need to also understand that those technologies are very, very hard for the wider public to access right now. And they are growing in ways which have attracted certain type of person who can understand how they manifest themselves. So against the potential, which I think is significant, is also the caution that legitimacy comes from some sense of informed participation. Mm-hmm. And these things are still quite niche and they're extremely powerful. And they will be framed by the people who are out there framing them. So the good news is that I think there are technical solutions to some of these issues. The worry is, can we get a broad enough conversation around them before they get set in stone?
Mm-hmm. And the hypothetical kind of new structure, if I understand it correctly, you and James talked about a hypothetical Uber competitor called Kuber, right? Right.
Yes.
And if I understand it correctly, the notion here is that with these decentralized autonomous organizations using the blockchain, one could create a competitor to Uber, right, that would compensate both drivers and passengers in part with tokens, which would effectively be equity or ownership in this new company. And you'd also have to structure it so that drivers were paid in local currency so they could make a good living. And such an Uber competitor could operate with close to zero profit margins. So hypothetically, drivers could be paid better. Passengers would have an incentive to use this new service because they would have more upside as well. And so if this proves to be a more competitive model, right, you could end up with future Ubers and Facebooks and so on that are actually owned very meaningfully by the people who use them. Is that the idea?
That is absolutely the idea. And in fact, there is a great example in Bengaluru in India called Drife, D-R-I-F-E, which is set up exactly in that way. There is a Drife token, and the Drife token, it will ultimately have some value, and you'll be able to exchange it for another cryptocurrency like Ethereum or Solana or into USD or some other sort of traditional fiat currency. And the code within that blockchain will determine the pricing. There will be incentivization schemes for loyalty, both of the riders and the drivers. And there will be, I think the thing that many people don't understand around blockchains, this idea of open governance. So it's a highly democratized. Mm-hmm. Everyone who will hold a Drife token will be able to vote on key decisions or delegate that vote to somebody they trust. And so we are starting to see those types of things emerge. And, you know, the nice thing is because we, the drivers and the riders, are the shareholders, we essentially funnel the profit back to us right at the beginning through the pricing and the mm-hmm. cut that mm-hmm. that the platform takes of every ride. So we are starting to see those things emerge. And one of the things about the story of technology, Rufus, that you and I sort of have lived, is that what seems incredibly complicated and difficult, and so you have to rely on a big centralized organization to do, through technology can often become really, really cheap and smaller groups can do it. And a simple example from our publishing days is that desktop publishing turned magazine production from something that only Condé Nast mm-hmm. could do to something that you know, you and I could do for a couple of $100.
Exactly right. Yeah. Well, no, I think it's, I mean, obviously we're going to have to be very careful as individuals and as, you know, communities and as countries to be smart about how we regulate these businesses and manage technology in our lives. But I find it very hopeful to think that there may be some new models that are emerging that could be alternatives to this sort of profit maximizing trajectory that we've seen for so many of these large companies for decades now, that's had the result of just ever greater concentration of wealth. So I'm cautiously hopeful that the blockchain and decentralized autonomous organizations could be part of the solution. I'm also very interested in what the implications are potentially for network-based governance. And you know, when we think about how we're organized in these, in the United States anyway, in states and countries, you point out at one point that the cities are really where the central organizing principles of this exponential age. Do you think that the way we think about the governance of cities needs to evolve?
Well, I really think the governance of cities does need to evolve because we're an urbanizing species, and every advanced economy sees this agglomeration of people in cities, and it's through large populations in cities that we see the specialization of labor that ends up driving up wages. And then to finally cap it all, the environmental costs, both carbon and others, of cities on a per capita basis are far lower than people who don't live in cities. And so there is a really strong arrow that points to the growing power of cities for figuring out both the local conditions of their inhabitants, but also tackling aspects of climate change. But that's not necessarily reflected in their ability to access the full resources of the state, because cities, in many cases, don't really have tax-raising power, and they are reliant on a national government. And in many countries, and I certainly know it's the case in the United Kingdom and the case of the US, the way that sort of voting works is that the urban dwellers' vote counts for less in the sort of final tally than the person who lives in the countryside. And there was a negotiation in the case of the US back in the 1780s around the relative power of states over cities and states within the overall power structure. And we've been a bit more haphazard in the UK, to be fair. But we need to understand that the power of those cities and how they are going to be continue to be the dynamo of progress. And I think in the emerging world and also in China, people have understood the power of the city. I mean, China is building these megalopolises of 75, 80, 100 million people connecting huge cities together with high-speed rail and creating these sort of integrated yet differentiable economies that will be able to benefit from agglomeration effects and sustainability effects in quite a directed way. And of course, the structure of that politics is very different to what we have in the UK or the US. But we need to find some way that enables cities to meet their potential. I think America is slightly ahead of the UK in all of that anyway, because mayors tend to have a little bit more power than they do on this side of the Atlantic.
I loved your quote from complexity scientist Jeffrey West, who I love, who says cities are one big positive feedback loop, growing, creating more jobs, improving people's lives, becoming more attractive and growing more. Well, Azim, thank you so much for taking time out of your startup investing and writing of books and newsletters and raising of children to be with us today. We so enjoyed the conversation.
I absolutely loved it. And I'm just going to say that 2 decades has been too long for us to leave in between our conversations, Rufus. So I hope we have a chance to chat again.
Absolutely. I look forward to it. Thank you so much, Azim. Have a great haircut.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Would you like to hear not 3, but 5 big ideas from the exponential age? Of course you would. Download the Next Big Idea app and check out Azim's Book Bite. And don't stop there. In our app, you will also find 12-minute audio summaries of other brilliant new books, a new one every single day, mind-blowing e-courses, and Zoom discussions with our curators, Adam Grant, Susan Cain, Malcolm Gladwell, and Daniel Pink. Search for Next Big Idea in your app store. If you like this show, leave us a review and a 5-star rating. It really helps us if you think we've earned it. Follow us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, the Wondery app, the Next Big Idea app, or wherever you're listening right now. Thank you, Azim Azar. I highly recommend his newsletter, Exponential View, which you can find by following the link in our show notes. This episode was written and produced by Caleb Bissinger. Our executive producer is Michael Kovnat. Theme music by Costa Galanopoulos. Sound design by Mike Toda. I'm your host, Rufus Griscom. See you next week.